or what would have been the fourth lecture if we had kept to the planned pace. And this is about the confinement-deconfinement phase transition. Okay, so everything we've said so far was about n equals 4 super young mills, either at zero temperature or finite temperature. And that's a theory that's not confining. And what I'd like to do today is to show you how you can construct the string description of a theory that's confining. And moreover, we will see that when you put that theory at finite temperature and you raise the temperature, eventually you go through a phase transition into a deconfined phase. Okay? So we will understand what that corresponds to on the gravity side. So let me tell you what's a very simple way of starting with something that you know and constructing a theory that's confining at low energies. So this is a simple construction of a confining theory, of a four-dimensional confining theory. So for this purpose, suppose we start not with D3 brains, but with D4 brains. This means we start in 5 dimensions, not in 4 dimensions. OK, so we start what I mean by starting with D4 brains is that on the gauge theory side, we look at the work volume theory on the D4 brains. For D3 brains, this was n equals 4 super young mills in 4 dimensions. In this case, what we have is, of course, a five-dimensional theory, one dimension higher. But it's still an SUNC, where NC is now the number of D4 brains, maximally supersymmetric Young-Mills theory. So it's very similar to n equals 4, but it's in one dimension higher. Yes, the work volume theory on a DP brain, or NCDP brains, is always maximally supersymmetric. This means 16 supercharges, SUN. Well, so n equals something depends. That's a language that depends on the dimension you are in. So if I say n equals 4, OK, this is an aside. N equals 4 in D equals 4 means 16 supercharges. OK? But if you say n equals 4 in 2 dimensions, that doesn't mean 16 supercharges, OK? Because the dimension of the spinor changes. So, but what is always, so using this language when you move up and down in dimension is not always the best thing to do if you want to keep the number of supercharges fixed. So what is always true is that on the work volume of NCDPs, you always have a D equals P plus 1 theory with 16 SUSEs. OK? Now, into how many spinors you can combine those and say n equals whatever number of spinors, that depends on the dimension. OK? Very good. So start with this theory, and let me remind you what the field content is for this theory. OK? Can somebody tell me? What is the field theory, the field content of super Young-Mills theory? In a maximally supersymmetric super Young-Mills theory, say in 5 dimensions. OK, gauge fields, first of all, very good. Fermions. And what else? OK, but physical degrees of freedom. Scalars. Okay. So this is spin 1, a half, and 0. OK. And now, can somebody tell me in what representation of the gauge group these guys are? In the adjoint representation. Okay. This means that everybody here has two color indices, two SUNC indices. Okay. That is not the case in QCD. In QCD, the fermions have one color index, the quarks. In pure Young-Mills, the only thing you would have is the gauge bosons. So what I'm going to do is to tell you how to go from this theory to pure Young-Mills. And that's going to be good enough for us, because pure Young-Mills, even without quarks, is supposed to be a confining theory. Okay, pure glue dynamics is a non-abelian theory that confines on low energies. Exactly. So the spectrum consists of globules. Globules are gauge invariant color singlets constructed only with glue, as opposed to glue and quarks.
So layer fermion spectrum?
Sorry?
Layer fermion spectrum?
This one way to, okay, this is a statement about this theory, but one way to understand why that has to be the case is that this is maximally supersymmetric. So all of these guys have to be in the same representation of the gauge group, okay? Because they are all related by supersymmetry transformations. And supersymmetry doesn't change the representation of the gauge group. It commutes. So I can go from this to this to that by acting with supercharges, and I'm not changing the representation. So they have to be in the same one, okay? Yes? If I had less than maximal supersymmetry, then it could happen that some of these guys are related, but they are unrelated to this. And then I could have them in different representations. Okay? Very good. So what I want to do is to get rid of this and that and construct a theory that at low energies only has gauge bosons. Okay? And that's going to give me pure glow dynamics. So one way to do that, that's very simple, is to compactify now this theory, take one of the spatial directions and put it on a circle. That goes under the name of compactifying the theory. OK, I put it on an S1 with length L. OK? This is a Kaluza-Klein reduction of this theory. And I'm going to impose antiperiodic boundary conditions for the fermions around the S1. Why am I doing that? Because then, if you impose antiperiodic boundary conditions for the fermions, then the zero mode, which would be the mode that's independent of this direction, that's constant, that's projected out. Because that is periodic. It doesn't satisfy the boundary condition that I'm imposing. Okay? So this kills the fermion zero mode. Just a sec. Yeah. Exactly. So what this means is that when you take your fermions and decompose them, expand them in harmonics, okay, around the circle, the zero mode is projected out, and all the rest have a mass that's at least of order 1 over L. Is this clear to everybody? Everybody knows that when you impose, when you put the theory in a circle, then the massive modes have masses at least of order 1 over the size of the circle, yes? Does somebody not know this? Very good. So this is one of the exercises. OK, all you have to do is, suppose you have a field here, phi of x and y, expand it as a sum over phi sub n of x e to the I n y. OK, apply the Laplace operator here. When it acts in the y direction, you get an n squared. Okay, it's a second derivative. And that gives you a contribution to the mass in four dimensions. So the mass in 4D is mass squared in five dimensions plus n squared. Sorry, n squared over L squared. Because for this to be periodic, I have to put a 1 over L here. Okay, so the mode with n equals 0, if it was massless in five dimensions, remains massless, but the rest of them acquire mass of order 1 over L. Okay? Very good. So this means that the mass of all the fermions squared is at least of order 1 over L squared. This is a tree level, OK? I'm not including any quantum effects. This is just an antiperiodic boundary condition. And now the scalars, at tree level, they are periodic. So they don't acquire a tree level mass. But through quantum effects, because they couple, everybody's coupled to everybody here, OK? Then for the scalars, there's a one loop mass that gets generated through a diagram like this, for example. Okay? This is a scalar, and a fermion. And this is a one loop correction to the scalar propagator. Okay? So if these guys are massive, then eventually this generates a mass in the exact quantum corrected propagator for the scalars. Okay? So the conclusion is that by doing this compactification, we get that both the fermions and the scalars become masses. Okay? And the mass scale is of order 1 over L. For the scalars, possibly 1 over L times some power of the coupling constant, because it's a quantum effect. Now, let's take a survey. Who thinks that these guys acquire a mass by some similar mechanism? Who thinks you think they do? Maybe, OK, that's good enough. Who thinks they don't? OK, why? Very good, but that's circumstantial. Who has a good argument why, without doing any calculations, I know these guys cannot acquire mass? Gauge invariance. OK, this is a gauge theory. Gauge invariance forbids a mass for the gauge bosons. If you write a mass term for these guys, that's not gauge invariant. So unless by compactifying here, I'm breaking the gauge symmetry, which I'm not, OK, I haven't done anything to break the gauge symmetry, then the zero mode of these guys cannot acquire a mass, because then I would be breaking gauge invariance. Yes? Very good. So that means that at energies much smaller than m, this compactification scale, the only massless degrees of freedom are the gauge bosons. The zero mode on the circle of the gauge bosons. OK? Yes? So here, the only massless fields are the non-abelian gauge bosons. So what this suggests is that the dynamics in this theory is the following. If you probe the theory at different energy scales, there's a scale m of order 1 over L, above which the theory is really five-dimensional. Why? Because above this scale, the energies at which I'm probing the theory are higher than the mass of all the modes. Okay, so all the modes participate in the dynamics, because I have enough energy to excite them. But if I'm below this scale, in particular way below, then I don't have enough energy. Okay, so I'm doing some scattering process, for example. I don't have enough energy to create these particles. So the dynamics is dominated only by the modes, the gauge bosons. All right? And that's just a zero mode. So this is a four-dimensional theory below that scale. You have to go to energies that are high enough to start seeing that you have a small radius. Yes? And this is also the reason why the world could be 10-dimensional, and there could be 6 dimensions that we don't see, because they are too small. And unless we have enough energy to excite those modes, we won't be able to see them. OK? Very good. So if the theory below this scale behaves more or less like a non-abelian theory with only gauge bosons, that's pure Young-Mills theory, we know that theory develops a dynamical scale, lambda, what's called usually lambda QCD, or lambda Young-Mills, and confines. Yes? That we know because we can put it on the lattice, we can study it by several methods, and we believe the theory is a confining theory. So what this construction is giving me is, by starting with a five-dimensional theory and compactifying at low energies, not at any energy scale, but at low energies, I generate a theory that is very similar to Young-Mills and confines. OK? So of course, what we would like to do is to be able to take this scale, m, to be much, much bigger than this one. Why? Because the theory we really want to study is pure Young-Mills, because that has all the properties that QCD has, and that's what we want to study. So I want to be able to study the dynamics down here with as little contamination as possible from additional degrees of freedom that are massive that I'm not interested in. These degrees of freedom are affecting the dynamics and modifying it. So if they change it too much, then the theory that I'm studying is not really the one I want. But in the limit in which this m becomes much, much bigger than this, the effect of these modes, okay, for example, If these modes have a Planck mass and I'm studying the proton, I don't care about those modes. They have very little effect. So that's what we want. However, and this is one of the most important things about gauge string duality, you will see, or I will explain to you, that you cannot decouple this scale from that scale if you are using supergravity. So in the regime, in the dual string description that I'll give you in a second, in which you want to decouple these two scales, the spacetime where this ADS-like geometry where you're doing string theory becomes highly curved. And then you have to do string theory. And that's really hard, and we don't know how to do that in these backgrounds. If we could, we would have solved large chain QCD already. But because we can't, and the best we know how to do, roughly speaking, is supergravity with a few more tricks, in the supergravity approximation, you're forced into the regime in which these two scales are of the same order. So even though you're studying it's a confining theory, it's a confining theory that has a lot of degrees of freedom that QCD doesn't have. So you're never sure that what you're calculating really applies to QCD. You would only be sure if you send this scale to infinity, keeping this one fixed. In that limit, this reduces exactly to what you want. Is this clear? I'm spending a few minutes on this because this is universal to every single example of gauge string duality. And this is the reason why we have not solved QCD using string theory. Okay? So the final comment before I write down the string description is that another thing that you expect is that if this is a confining theory at low energies, if I introduce temperature, then at some point I have to go through a thermal phase transition, because if I'm in a confining theory and I start heating it up, okay, at some point thermal fluctuations are going to be so violent that they have to break apart the gluon bound states. Okay, so I should expect a thermal phase transition to happen at some critical temperature, TD confinement. Okay, so the reason I'm saying this is because now I'm going to write down the string description of this theory at finite temperature, and we will see the physics how it changes as we change the temperature. Okay, any questions about the strategy? No.
Because those, I thought, like, you can do the sort of Korfuel plasma break we did yesterday.
Yeah.
The deconfined. Now we want to study the baryon states. That's why we're.
Yeah, what you would want is not just to study the deconfined phase of QCD, but you would also like to understand the confining. First of all, you would like to understand confinement,
right,
which we don't. Yeah. Chiral symmetry breaking, okay, et cetera, et cetera. All that physics of low energy QCD, which are non perturbative in nature, yeah, we don't really have a handle on those. So we would want to have a string construction that not only allows us to study the high temperature phase, but also the low temperature phase.
This is kind of like it's alpha strong going to be kind
of like,
right?
No. As you move down, alpha strong grows. Okay, in QCD, the coupling constant as a function of energy grows when you go to lower energies. At high energies, you have asymptotic freedom.
Right.
So the coupling goes to zero. But at low energies, it grows. It grows so much that the theory confines, et cetera, et cetera. So the infrared regime in QCD is a difficult one. That's where all the non-perturbative physics takes place. And that's the one we would like to study using a weakly coupled description in terms of streams. Any more questions?
So could you say again why we want D4 brains now instead of
So the reason I start with D4s is because that gives me, and this is not the only way to get to construct something that at low energies is a confining theory that more or less looks like what you want. There are other ways of doing it.
And with D3 brains, they won't be
confined. No, there is a way to do it with D3 brains, but it's more complicated. And that's why I'm not going into it. It's more complicated, not on the gauge theory side, okay, but on the string description, constructing, going from n equals 4 super young meals to a confining background is actually much more complicated. Okay? As you will see, the string description of this theory is extremely simple. It's almost the same as what we had so far. That's why I'm choosing this example. Okay, so let's write down. So what do we have to do now? Well, we have to follow what we did with D3 brains, but now with D4 brains. So what I have to do is write down the metric and the dilaton and other fields, but in particular the metric corresponding to the D4 brain solution now, not the D3 brain solution. I want to have that metric with finite temperature. Okay? And I want to take the y direction, this circle, to be compact. So let me write down the metric, and then I'll motivate why that's the correct metric to write down. So the metric takes the following form. There's, again, some power of R over a scale, capital R. Okay. Where this F is 1 minus R0 cubed over R cubed. So let me take you through this expression so that you understand each of the terms. So the first thing you see is that here now, for D3 brains, I had time and 3 spatial directions. Now I have time. These are 3 spatial directions and an additional spatial direction because now I have D4 brains. Okay, my gauge theory now is 4 plus 1 dimensional, not 3 plus 1. So that's why I get 4 plus 1. Okay? In front of dt squared, I have f, which is almost exactly the same as I had for D3 brains, except that this power in that case was 4, here it's 3. But that's just because when you solve Einstein's equations, you get different powers. But you see that, as before, when r goes to r0, this goes to 0. And so gtt goes to 0, and so there's a horizon at r equals r0. It's exactly the same as for D3 brains, yes? So the picture, similarly to before, is that now we have a horizon at r equals r0. And you see that instead of a phi sphere here, as I had for D3 brains, I have a 4 sphere. Why? Because the space transverse to D3 brains, D3s and D4s live in 10 dimensions. So the space transverse to D3 brains has 6 directions, one of which is the radius, and the other 5 gave me the 5 sphere. Now the space transverse to D4s has only 5 dimensions because I have one more longitudinal direction. And so I have the radius and a 4 sphere. And also note that for D3 brains, the radius of the sphere was constant. It was just r squared. Okay, capital R is a constant. Now it depends on the radius. And also, if you write the dilaton, this is given by r over r to the 3/4. So the main difference between this metric and the D3 brain metric is that because you have now different powers of R here and here and here, if you compute the Ricci scalar, okay, the curvature, for this metric, you will find that it's not constant. Okay? So the Ricci scalar now is not a constant. And the dilaton for D3 brains was constant. I don't know if I emphasized this, but because I always only wrote down the metric. But the dilaton for D3 brains is constant. For D4 brains, you see it's not. It runs. It changes with R. OK? So e to the phi, again, is not constant. Now, remember that the dilaton is related to the effective string coupling. Remember? That G effective was e to the phi. Do you all remember this? That the expectation value of the dilaton gives you the effective string coupling constant. And remember that, so this is GS, if you like. And remember that this the string coupling was proportional to G squared Young Mills. Do you all remember this as well? OK, for D3s. So for D3 brains, the fact that the dilaton was constant corresponded to the fact that G squared Young Mills was constant. Why? Because N equals 4 super Young Mills is a conformal theory. And so the coupling is really independent of energy. It's really a coupling constant. For this theory, this is not a conformal theory. This theory has scales, and it changes with energy, the physics. So in this theory, the coupling constant is not a constant. It runs with energy. And that's why the dilaton is not constant. That's a very important difference. Is this clear? OK. In particular, you see that if you go to large values of R, the dilaton blows up. OK, it grows with R. This means, and remember, going to large values of R in the gauge theory corresponds to going to high energies. Yes? So when I move in this direction in the geometry, the dilaton grows, which means the coupling constant in the gauge theory grows. So I'm moving in this direction, and the coupling constant is growing. Is this what I should expect? The answer is yes. And why? Because this theory, remember, we started with five-dimensional super Young Mills theory. Yes? That theory is not renormalizable. That's not a renormalizable theory. In particular, the coupling constant in that theory grows with energy. So when you start going to higher and higher energies, you actually need a UV completion of the theory. The theory by itself is not defined up to arbitrarily high scales. You have to impose a cutoff. Okay? It's not renormalizable. If you want to remove the cutoff, you have to modify the dynamics up here. Give some UV completion that makes sense of the theory. Okay? Is this clear? Yes? OK. But this is not a problem, because this theory does have a UV completion, which is a six-dimensional conformal theory. One very simple way of seeing that is if you know that you started with T4 brains. I don't know if in the string theory course you should have seen this, but I don't know if you did. D4 brains can be obtained by dimensional reduction of M5 brains. Does this sound like Chinese? No. It does? OK. Or does it sound like Spanish? OK, if you don't know this, don't worry about it. Let me just say that you can actually give a UV completion of this theory in terms of an ultraviolet fixed point, which is a six-dimensional theory. OK? So we will not worry about the UV dynamics, because in any case, we're interested in the physics down here. All I'm pointing out is that this behavior is exactly what the gravity solution is reproducing for you. So everything is consistent. OK? And precisely because if you go to high enough energies, this theory becomes strongly coupled. It's not renormalizable. You have to make sense of it. You should, at the same time, on the gravity side, not expect to be able to trust this solution at arbitrarily high values of R. OK? Why? Because the dilaton is blowing up. And if the dilaton is blowing up, then you have to do something with it. You cannot trust the supergravity description. OK? Because when the dilaton blows up, remember, this is the effective string coupling. So string loop effects become important up here. Okay? But in any case, as I said, we'll be interested. All these problems are there, but they will not affect what I'm going to explain. It's the opposite. It's the other way around. So here, when I say the coupling increases, what I mean is the five-dimensional coupling. Okay, this G5, there's one of the exercises is about understanding all of this, and I highly recommend that you do it, because you will learn a lot. So this five-dimensional coupling has dimensions. Okay, so G squared in five dimensions, this is, if you like, G squared Young Mills in the 5D theory. This has dimensions of length. You can verify that. So the dimensionless coupling is this times the energy. And then you see that this is not renormalizable, right? Because at high energies, the coupling grows. OK, by naive power counting. So this is why this theory has to be completed in the UV. OK, and the final comment is that this y direction here, which is one of the D4 directions, we will take it to be compact with length on a circle with length L. Why? Because we want to think of the theory living in these directions as the gauge theory, as we did for D3 brains. Okay? So y here is periodically identified with period L. OK? Any more questions? Very good. Now, this R0, remember, in the case of D3 brains, this was related to the temperature. OK? You all look really tired and really passive. I think I could be telling you lots of lies, and you wouldn't care. So you must be really tired. OK. But I'm not getting any feedback, so I don't know if I'm talking and you're understanding me or not. Yeah?
Just a question. So it's R cubed because we have an extra dimension now?
Yeah. The power you get here depends on how many dimensions you have here.
Oh, okay.
And that is just a technicality that you can see when you plug this into, if you take this metric and you plug it into Einstein's equations,
yeah,
and you solve for F, okay, Einstein's equations determine what F must be, that power depends on how many dimensions you have here. It's just what you get when you solve the equations of motion. There's nothing very deep. All that matters is that this, as you move up, goes to 1, okay, when R is large, and so it doesn't affect the physics up here, as you would expect, because the temperature should only change the physics around a scale similar to the temperature. If you go to very high energy, you don't care that you have high temperature. Okay, so I was saying, as in the case of D3 brains, this R0 is as well related to the temperature. And how do we see this? Well, in the same way that we did for D3 brains. The simplest way is take this metric and do the continuation to Euclidean signature. Okay, so tau becomes I tau Euclidean. And then what you have, so this is the radial direction and this is R0. See, tau Euclidean is periodic. And the circle, so this is, how do I call it? T Euclidean. That has period beta, which is one of the temperature. You see, at R equals R0, GTT goes to 0. Okay, in Euclidean signature, this is a plus. Okay, and so you have to periodically identify this with the appropriate period so that you don't get a singularity down here. All right. If you do that, you find that R0 is given by 4 pi over 3 squared. R cubed over beta squared. Well, remember, beta is one of the temperature. Okay. And now, if you look at the other circle, y, this circle has period. What am I calling it? This is y. Has period L, which is 1/m. Remember, m is the compactification scale. But this circle is non-contractible, because even though when you go from R equals infinity to R equals R0, the size of this circle changes, because it's proportional, there's a factor of R here. At R equals R0, this is finite, and so the size of this circle remains finite. Okay? So this geometry has a contractible, in Euclidean signature, a contractible time circle, and a non-contractible y circle. OK? And this is going to be very important. Why is this so important? Because now, in view of this, and in fact, I should write down, let me write down here the Euclidean solution. So let me call this the black hole solution, OK, clearly, because there's a horizon. That's why I'm calling it that way. So in Euclidean signature, this is this. Yes, I don't want to get anybody lost here, because this is an important point. So now, I'm going to make a very trivial, in fact, observation, but that has far-reaching consequences, which is the following. I claim that there is another solution to the equations, to Einstein's equations, with the same boundary conditions at infinity, okay, namely that I have two circles, which takes the following form. D squared is the same power here, and then I get dt squared, dt Euclidean squared, plus dx squared, plus f dy squared, plus r over r to the 3/2, dr squared over f. And by the way, from now on, because the sphere is not going to play any role in what I'm going to say, I'm just going to erase this bit. It's there, remember it's there, but it won't play any role. So I don't want you to get distracted with that. And I don't want to write so much. OK, so I claim this is also a solution that has the same boundary conditions as this one. OK? Can somebody tell me why this is a solution? Exactly. All I did was to relabel what I was calling tau Euclidean or t Euclidean and y. OK? So now let me draw the analogous picture to that one. Now here, in this solution, what I have, so remember, this is what we call the black hole solution. OK? And I'm going to call this one the ADS soliton solution, for lack of a better name. I didn't invent it, but yes?
When you relabel them, don't you change
the gravity conditions? Wait, I'm getting there. So let me draw that picture, and then that will make it clear. So this is R, again. This is R star. And now this circle, both this guy and this guy, remain periodic. Okay, they are both periodically identified. So this is, again, t Euclidean with period beta, which is one of the t. And I have the white circle with period L, which is 1 over m. But now this one is the non-contractible one, because this one, gt Euclidean, t Euclidean, remains finite when r goes to or not. Okay, so this now does this. Whereas this one is the contractible one. Okay? Yes? Now, coming back to your question, see, if I now impose that the gravity, that this gravitational solution is regular, I have to focus on this point. This is where potentially I get a conical singularity. Okay? So now R naught, which was here determined in terms of the temperature, on this side, R naught is determined in terms of L. Okay? L here plays the role that beta was playing over there. Do you see this? Yes? Okay. So now R naught. Can somebody guess for me what the expression for R naught is? Very good, very good. So R naught now is, again, 4 pi over 3 squared R cubed divided by L squared. Divided by L squared, because you see L has dimensions of length, just like beta, because beta is 1 over temperature, OK? So, and beta plays the role of L over there, and vice versa, OK? So see what we've done? What we're doing is we're fixing the boundary conditions at infinity. I'm saying I have two circles, one with this period and one with this period. But then I discover that I can write two different gravity solutions with those boundary conditions. And by the way, now, this solution in Euclidean signature is just a relabeling of this one. But if you now go back to Lorentzian signature here, the solution you get is dramatically different from this one. Okay? So let's do that. Here in Lorentzian signature, we have a minus. Can somebody tell me what I have here? Very good. I still have a minus. Okay. But now let's look at this solution. This solution has a horizon. Okay, this is a Lorentzian spacetime with a horizon at r equals r naught, because gtt goes to 0. Does this solution have a horizon? No. This solution smoothly closes off at r equals r naught. Okay? So r equals r naught in this solution plays the role of the origin of coordinates, of polar coordinates. But gtt remains finite everywhere. There is no horizon. This solution here is completely smooth and horizon free. Okay? Was there a comment or a question? GRR? What about GRR? No, this is also finite because now the radial coordinate only goes from r equals infinity to r equals r naught. Right? Because, so let me draw, if you like, an equivalent picture of these two geometries. So let me erase this. Okay, so I'm going to give you an alternative picture. One way to draw this in Lorentzian signature is the following. So this is Euclidean. This is Lorentzian. This is the radial direction. Okay. This is the y direction, this circle here. And these are the x directions, these ones here. Okay, so I have some infinite non-compact Cartesian-like directions, a radial direction, and the y circle. Okay. In this solution, I have a horizon. So at r equals r naught, which is here, gtt goes to 0. And what this means is that my spacetime has a horizon that's extended in these directions. Is this picture clear? When I reach this point here is r equals r naught here. OK? And there I hit a horizon. If I draw the analogous picture here, what I get is that r equals r naught just plays the role of the origin of the polar plane. Okay, if you shift r, you can set r naught here to 0. And then this is again the radial direction, and this is the y direction, and this is the x direction. So you see, this geometry is completely smooth, and it has no horizon anywhere or singularities. Yes? Very good.
Question?
Yes.
To go back to Alex's remark, f still vanishes at r equals r naught, mm-hmm. and grr still contains the one where f. So grr should diverge at r
naught. Ah, very good. Very good. That's not the case, because if you take precisely the condition between the relationship between r naught and l that I wrote down, ensures this is one of the exercises. You could have asked me the same question up here as down here. Yes? But precisely the point is that if you take this bit of the metric and this one in this case, or this one and this one in the other case, then you can see that T Euclidean and R, or Y and R here, this is R and this is Y. Okay, these two coordinates, you might think that here you have a singularity precisely of what you're, because of what you're saying, that this blows up. But if you change coordinates near this point and you periodically identify y with the appropriate period, you will see that this is just the origin of the polar plane. There's no singularity. Is this clear?
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that in both pictures you never have GRR blowing up?
No, GRR in these coordinates may appear or may blow up. But as you know, that doesn't mean anything by itself. You have to look at the intrinsic geometry. I can write down the metric on flat space in a coordinate system in which some of the metric components blow up. Yes? Is this clear? Okay, if you write this metric. I can make a change of coordinates. It gives me exactly the same metric, but in those new coordinates, some of the metric components will blow up at some point. But that by itself doesn't mean anything. I have to see if there's a coordinate redefinition that removes, whether it's a real singularity or a coordinate singularity. And what I'm saying is that this, if you periodically identify y with the appropriate period, and only in that case, this is just a coordinate singularity. That's precisely where you get the condition for the period.
This one has a horizon.
When this goes to zero, where GTT goes to zero.
But how do you know that that's horizon?
Ah, very good. OK. How do I know it's regular?
Well, like if you look at.
Excellent. So just by looking at GTT going to zero, I know that something may be happening, but that doesn't prove that it's a regular horizon, meaning it's a horizon. And I can go through it by changing coordinates. OK, it could be a singularity, but it's not. Okay, this is something that you can just investigate. If you look at the Lorentzian solution, you can show that you can change coordinates and go through. It's the same as what happens in the Schwarzschild solution, right? When you look at the metric in the usual.
Like in Kerr-Newman, for example, you have a horizon at GTT equals zero, you have GR equals to infinity, and they both give you two different horizons, and GR equals to infinity is only the real physical one. But GTT equals zero is just some surface.
Very good, very good. So you're saying that GTT equals zero is not always the location of the horizon. Yes, in this case it is. But you're correct.
So how come in this picture you drew L along the radius? So L is supposed to be the period of y?
Yes.
It's not drawn along an arrow.
No, L is this.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry. So this is why. Okay, as in here. Okay. So yes.
Are we gonna think of this new solution as still as a dimensional reduction of a D4 brain?
Yes, both solutions. Let me go now to the interpretation. Okay. Because we seem to have too many solutions. Because I started wanting to construct the gravity solution dual to D4 brains compacted type of circuit. And I have found two of them at finite temperature. Okay? Because both of them satisfy the boundary conditions at infinity that I want, which is that the Euclidean time direction is compact because I'm at finite temperature. And one of the spatial directions, y, is compact because I want to Kaluza kind of reduce the five-dimensional theory to four dimensions. Yes? So what's happening is that we have found two saddle points in the approximation to the exact partition function of string theory with these boundary conditions. In other words, you specify the boundary conditions at infinity. If we were doing an exact path integral over geometries here, remember the partition function tells you to integrate over all the string fields, in particular over metrics, with fixed boundary conditions. Yes? OK. We are not evaluating exactly this path integral. What we are doing is doing a saddle point approximation. We are looking for classical solutions, because those will dominate the path integral. OK? In many cases, you only find one classical solution. But in this case, we found two. So both of them, in principle, can contribute to the path integral. Is this clear? It's like doing a path integral in quantum mechanics for the propagator to go from x to y. And evaluating this in the classical or semi-classical approximation, you look for a classical solution. And it just may happen that if the geometry where the particle is propagating is complicated enough, you find more than one. And then you have to sum over all of them when you do the classical approximation. Okay? However, the point here is going to be that the contribution of each of them for different values of the temperature, it's always the case that one of them is infinitely suppressed with respect to the other one. So let me explain this. Let me explain it over here. So because we're working at finite temperature, what we are interested in is in looking at the free energy of each of these solutions. Okay? So the relative contribution to the partition function, the ratio of the contributions, is given by e to the minus beta times f1 times the volume divided by e to the minus beta times f2 times the volume. So let me explain this. Beta is 1 over the temperature. F1 and F2 are the free energy densities per unit volume of these two solutions. Per unit volume, I mean per unit volume in these directions. Why am I looking at densities? Because these are infinitely extended directions, so the total free energy is infinite. Okay? So the total free energy is the free energy density times the volume. And the same for the other one. So when you compute the path integral, you would have a contribution that comes with this factor, because it's a thermal partition function for the first solution. And the other one would contribute with this other factor. And what I'm looking at is the ratio between the two to see if they can compete or if I can throw one of them away. Yes?
Yeah, so why don't you use L for the other one instead of beta?
No, because now, no. Because in the thermal partition function, what you have to do is to evaluate the energy and divide it by the temperature. And that gives you the contribution to the thermal partition function.
But so which one is the temperature? How do we know if it's beta or L?
No, beta, OK. The temperature is always the, or whatever the temperature, is always the period of the Euclidean time.
OK.
OK? Yes? Mm-hmm. Whether or not you have another compact direction, that has nothing to do with, that doesn't enter the thermal contribution or the thermal weight to the partition function.
Yes, but if we relabel y to be t, then the period of the Euclidean time.
No. So when I said that this was a relabeling of that, that's just the way you realize that there's got to be another solution with the same boundary conditions. But now, suppose that I just entered the room and I told you, look, here's a solution to Einstein's equations. Here's another solution to Einstein's equations. They both have the same asymptotic boundary conditions. But in the interior, they are different. This one looks like this. That one looks like that. Now compute the contribution of each of them to the thermal partition function. Well, you have to compute the temperature here and the temperature here, right? Which is beta, and plug it into here. This is important, so I'm glad you asked. If that's OK? But now you see that because we are in the infinite volume limit, okay, the volume of the x directions is infinite. As soon as the free energy density in one solution and in the other is different, as soon as the free energy densities differ by a finite amount, when you multiply it by the volume, the difference in the total free energy is infinite. Okay? So it's always the case that one of them completely dominates over the other. Why does this happen? Because we're in the infinite volume limit. If we were working on a box, okay, both of them would give finite contributions to the partition function. One of them would be bigger and the other one would be smaller, but they would be always comparable. Okay? But when you take the thermodynamic limit, only one of them dominates. Okay? In fact, even if we were in finite volume, because we are working in the large N limit, even in finite volume, because you have still an infinite number of degrees of freedom, because you're taking nc to infinity, we would still have that one of them dominates completely over the other. Okay? But in any case, that's not important here, because we're in the thermodynamic limit in any case. Okay? Very good. So this is, of course, e to the minus beta delta f times v. And we just argued that when v goes to infinity, or if nc goes to infinity, then only one of them, one solution, dominates. what this means, and of course, and this is the key point, which solution dominates, meaning which solution has the lowest free energy, that depends on the temperature. This is the key observation. Why? Because if I were to compute the free energy here or here, that's going to depend on what the geometry is doing everywhere. Okay? And the geometry depends on beta. Why? Because R naught, remember, for example, in this case, depends on beta. Okay? So the calculation that we would have to do now is to compute the free energy in each case and then compare them and see which one is smaller for what temperatures. And that will tell us when one of them, when they cross, as I change the temperature, we will have a thermal phase transition. Okay? However, I'm not going to do the calculation because we can guess the result without doing it. Okay? So what I'm claiming is that there is going to be a temperature, T, deconfinement, that I'm going to call T deconfinement for reasons that will be clear in a second, at which there is a thermal phase transition. And one of these solutions, I'm saying, has the lowest free energy for temperatures below this temperature, and the other one has the lowest free energy for temperatures above this temperature. Yes? So if you were to plot the free energies, F1 and F2, as a function of temperature, you would find something like this, something like this, and something like that. So for temperatures below this temperature, this one dominates because it has the lowest free energy. And for temperatures above, the other one dominates. This is what would happen if you do the calculation. Okay? But I'm going to argue, I'm going to determine this temperature without doing the calculation. Can somebody give me a guess for what this temperature is? Very good. Why? Exactly. Exactly. By symmetry, in fact, okay, the first argument is this has to be m, or actually something proportional to m. Because this is the only dimension full scale I introduced in the problem. Okay? I'm looking at the physics as a function of temperature in a theory where the only scale is this mass over which I reduced the compactification scale. So it has to happen at that order. Now, whether it's exactly that, I'm going to argue now. How can we see this? Well, suppose I compute the free energy here. What is the free energy going to depend on? It's going to depend on the temperature, on my boundary conditions, in particular on the temperature and on L. Okay, if I move the temperature around and I change L around, then my free energy will change. Okay, the free energy is a function of T, or if you like, of beta and L. Okay? But now suppose that I tell you what the free energy is for this solution. Can you guess what the free energy is for that solution? It's the same, but with beta and L interchanged. Okay? For that reason, those two functions, if they cross, they must cross by symmetry at beta equals L. But beta equals L means T equals M. So it's precisely at this temperature that the two free energies cross, and you have a transition from one to the other. And it's a first order phase transition. Okay, there's a discontinuity. For example, if you compute the slope, which gives you the entropy, that's discontinuous. And I will actually give you more arguments for that. Okay, yes.
Yeah, so how do we know that this phase transition from one geometry to the other is the deconfinement?
Very good, I'll get to that. But let me first convince you that there's a phase transition, determine the transition temperature, and a couple other things. Now, the only thing I haven't yet told you is what is the solution that dominates for small temperatures, and what is the solution that dominates for high temperatures? Okay? We know there's a transition, and we have argued it must happen at this temperature, but we don't know what's on one side and what's on the other side yet. Okay? Any guesses? what's the solution that dominates for T below the confinement temperature and for T above the confinement temperature? I have a guess. Say, can you speak louder?
That one dominates below.
This one below? And this one above? Okay, anybody is with him? You agree?
Yeah.
Anybody else? Peer pressure? Anybody disagrees? You do. Anybody else? What do you think? You don't know? Okay, I disagree with you and I agree with you. So let me explain why. So the guess comes from, of course you have to do the calculation, but you can guess it in the following way. When you compute the free energy, the idea is the following. Gradients cost energy. Okay? That's the motto. So if you have, so the solution that has the lowest free energy, so this metric, you see, this metric and that metric both have a circle that doesn't contract to zero size, and one that does. Okay? Here it's the Euclidean time circle, here's the y circle. So if you try to contract a circle that's really big at infinity to zero size at a finite r, that's a huge gradient. That costs a lot of energy. So if I give you two solutions with two circles of different sizes, and I tell you, find me a gravitational solution in which one of them is non-contractible, but the other one contracts, the one with the lowest free energy is the one where you contract the circle with the smallest size, because then you don't have so much way to go. Okay? So you want to contract the smallest circle. So what that means is that here, so if I'm at T greater than M, okay, that means beta, which is 1 over T, smaller than L, which is 1 over M. Okay? So beta smaller than L, beta smaller than L means that this circle is smaller than this one. So when this circle, am I saying this right? Yeah, that's right. When this circle is smaller than this one, I want to contract this one. So this should be the correct solution that dominates the physics for T greater than M. And by the same argument, this one should be the solution for T smaller than M. Is the argument clear? Okay. Very good. So now that we know this, just a second, I'm going to argue now that this solution describes the deconfined phase of this gauge theory, and this solution describes a confining phase in the gauge theory. And once I convince you of that, then you know that there's a thermal phase, first order thermal phase transition between the confining phase for T smaller than T deconfinement into the high temperature phase, which is the deconfined phase. Okay?
I was going to ask, if we were really calculating the free energy, how would we do it?
Okay, so the way you do it is you say, you identify it. Well, actually, I will tell you a method to calculate it almost trivially in this case. In that case, it's a little harder. But if you want to do it from first principles, what you do is you identify the Euclidean action. This is the Einstein-Hilbert action in Euclidean signature. You declare that this is beta times the free energy. Right? Why? Because in thermal, in statistical mechanics or in thermodynamics, okay, in statistical field theory, you know that when you compute a path integral over some fields of e to the, so you start, for example, in Lorentzian signature, and you go to Euclidean signature, you get a minus here and a Euclidean. But of course, what are you computing? You're computing in Euclidean signature, if you impose boundary conditions on the time circle, you're computing the free energy, because you're at finite temperature, okay? The partition function gives you the free energy. It gives you e to the minus beta times f, okay? In the classical approximation, this is just e to the minus s Euclidean on a classical solution. Okay, you forget about integrating over fluctuations, and you just keep this term, and that's equal to that in the classical approximation. So that's why you use identification. So what I would have to do is look at the Einstein-Hilbert action and evaluate it on this solution and on that solution. The problem, the reason I'm not doing that on the blackboard is because that result is divergent. Okay, you have to regularize it. And that means you have to introduce something called counter terms and boundary terms and things like that. And that's technically, it's a little bit involved, and it doesn't shed any more light on the physics, especially if you can guess the result. Okay? But that's in principle what you would have to do. Okay, by the way, in the gravity literature, this phase transition in which you go from one geometry in which you have two cycles, which in this case are circles, but they could be spheres or something else. You have two cycles. On one side of the transition, one of them contracts, and on the other side, it's the other one. These type of phase transitions go under the name of Hawking-Page phase transitions in the gravity literature. Okay? Hawking and Page studied this many years ago without having in mind any sort of application or relationship to deconfinement phase transitions in gauge theories. Okay? So this goes under the name of Hawking Page. Now let me convince you that this one is the deconfined phase. And this one is the confining phase. Okay. Anybody can tell me, can give me an argument for that? Let's see. Let's look, for example, at the entropy density, shall we? I expect that the entropy density, okay, let me ask you, what do we expect the entropy density to be like in the deconfined phase? How should it scale, say, with the number of degrees of freedom, with nc?
Nc squared.
In the deconfined phase, all the quarks and gluons, or in particular in this case the gluons, contribute individually because they are not bound together. Okay, so the energy the entropy density should scale like nc squared. And this is what we found for n equals 4 super young Mills, if you remember. Okay. Now here, what's the entropy density? Well, I have to compute the area of the horizon because this solution has a horizon. So the entropy density is just the area of the horizon. Okay. Divided by Newton's constant. But remember, Newton's constant goes like gs squared, okay, which is 1 over nc squared. So when I compute s as area over 4g, this scales like 1 over g, which is 1 over gs squared, which is nc squared. Okay? So on this side, the entropy density scales like nc squared. This is a sign of the confinement. Okay? In the confined phase, the entropy density does not scale like nc squared because the degrees of freedom that contribute are the color singlets. Okay? So all the gluons contribute only in groups. So the entropy density does not scale like nc squared, but like nc to the zero. Okay? Or if you like, it scales as the number of glue ball states. But that number of glue ball states, that's not scaled with NC. So that is consistent over here, because here there is no horizon. So at leading order, the entropy is zero. Okay? So here you would say that the entropy density is zero. Of course, it's not really zero. It's zero to leading order in NC squared. It really scales like nc to the zero. If you do a loop calculation here, you will see that it's non-zero, but it's order one. Okay? But at leading order, when you're just doing classical gravity, you don't see it, because you only pick up the contribution of order nc squared. Okay? And the other argument why this is the deconfined phase is that now let's look at the force between a quark and an antiquark. If this force, when I pull them apart arbitrarily far away, is linear in the distance, I am in the confined phase, because it takes me an infinite amount of energy to pull them apart to infinity. If this, at some point, the potential becomes constant, so the force goes to zero, then I'm in a deconfined phase, because I need a finite amount of energy to pull them apart. Is this clear? So let's see what the Wilson loop is going to do, or the Wilson loop computes the quark-antiquark potential without doing the calculation. Just pictorially, we can actually see it. Because here, you see, if you put a quark and an antiquark, Q and Q bar, you're putting them separated a distance, a certain distance in the gauge theory directions, okay, which are the x directions. Yes? So the energy between this quark and antiquark corresponds to the length of the minimum length string connecting the two. Yes? So if I keep pulling them apart, then of course this becomes longer. But eventually, when I'm here, what the string is going to do is to break. Because then the minimum energy configuration is this one. Do you guys see this? Okay, when the string can just touch the horizon, or even earlier, it can happen if there is a phase transition. At some point, it stops being favorable to be connected, and it's favorable to minimize the length to actually do this. Of course, when they are very close together, this has a longer length than this. But eventually, this is the configuration that will dominate, that will have the minimum length. Just a second. And once this happens, the energy becomes independent of the separation, because now if I keep pulling them apart, the length doesn't change anymore. So the potential, in this case, V of R of delta X, initially grows with the distance, but then it goes to a constant. Yes?
When you say that the string breaks, does it mean that it's still connected, but through the surface R equals R naught?
Well, that's almost semantics. Because what I mean is that I'm looking for the minimum length configuration. And that just happens to be two copies of this configuration, where this is just a string that falls through the horizon. If you want to say that, in fact, what's happening is that this is lying closer and closer to the horizon, that's OK. That's something you have to solve the equation of motion to see. Right? But in any case, even if it's sitting on the horizon, because the metric becomes null, at that point, the energy is zero. The energy of this bit will be zero. Okay, so the important thing is that this goes to a constant, and so the force goes to zero. The force is the derivative. Okay, so the energy then becomes constant, and this is non-confining. Instead, on this side, if you look at the energy, eventually, what's going to happen is that the string wants to go down, sit here for a long time, and come up again. But now the point is that gxx here is non-zero. So this bit, this costs energy. So if I keep pulling them apart, what I get is something that looks closer and closer to a string falling all the way down, sitting here for a long length, and coming up again. So eventually, the energy will scale like this distance times the tension, the effective tension of this string down here. So here, V will go like sigma times delta x, where this sigma is this tension here. Okay. So you see that it grows linearly with the distance, and that's a sign of confinement. Any questions? Very good. So let me give you one more argument why this is the confining phase and that's the deconfined phase, just because this will be important later, and then I'll finish with that. Okay? So another way to see that this is confining and that is not is to look at the spectrum. You know that in a confining theory, the spectrum should be just color singlets, okay, possibly with a mass gap. which is not the case in the deconfined phase. So in order to find the spectrum, what you have to do, let me now erase this. So suppose that I want to find the global spectrum on this phase. What do I have to do? Well, globals are associated, are bound states of gluons only. So they are associated, they can be created by acting on the vacuum with this operator. Okay? So what I have to do to find the spectrum of globals is to look at the field, at the spectrum of the field dual to this operator. For example, any operator that has the right quantum numbers to create a global acting on the vacuum is good enough. In particular, trace of F squared is the simplest one. Okay? For example, just a second. Well, go ahead.
Do you mean the energy spectrum?
I mean the mass spectrum of globals. Right? So remember that the field dual to this operator is the dilaton. So what I have to do is to look for solutions of the dilaton equation of motion on this geometry that take the following form. They have the form of a plane wave in the x directions and some function of the radial direction. Why am I doing this? Because I want these modes to have a well-defined momentum in the gauge theory directions, because then the mass is simply minus k squared. Okay? So I'm looking for fluctuations of the dilaton in this background that have the form of a plane wave in the gauge theory directions, to which I can associate a well-defined momentum. Of course, the general solution will be a superposition. But then I won't be able to say that that solution has a well-defined momentum. Okay? Times some radial profile. Okay? So if you plug this into the equations of motion, what you get is an equation into the Laplace equation, say, nabla squared x and r over phi equals 0. When the derivatives act on this bit, you just get powers of k. And when they act on here, eventually what you get is a differential equation, an ordinary differential equation for h that depends on k squared. OK? Now, that differential equation, now you have to solve it demanding that the mode is normalizable at infinity. Why? Because suppose that you wanted to construct the Hilbert space of states of this field in this background. What would you do? You would solve the linear equation for this field with the condition that the solutions are normalizable so that you can define an inner product, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So we have to look, for physical states, we have to look at modes that are normalizable at infinity. But we also have to impose that they are regular at the origin. Okay? So we have two conditions, regularity at the origin and normalizability at infinity. And then it turns out, as it happens, this is a general statement about differential equations, that if you start down here with a regular solution and you integrate the equation out to infinity, in general, you get at infinity a superposition of the non-normalizable solution and the normalizable solution. Yes? Let me say it again. The differential equation has two independent solutions. At infinity, one of them is normalizable, and the other one is not. At the origin, one is regular, and the other one is not. But in general, if you start here with a regular one, when you propagate it out to infinity, you get a combination of the two, and vice versa. If you start with a normalizable one here, when you go to the interior, you get a superposition of the regular and the irregular. Okay? It's only for a discrete set of values of the parameter k squared that enters the differential equation that precisely the regular one here is also normalizable here. Yes? The general thing that in quantum mechanics gives you quantization of the energy. Okay, you want regularity and normalizability. So here it's exactly the same thing. What this means is that the values of k squared are discrete, as you would expect in a confining theory. You expect, like in QCD, that the masses of the hadrons, or mesons and baryons, have a discrete spectrum. And in fact, not only that, but you can prove that there is no solution that's regular and normalizable with k squared equals 0. That's really simple to prove. You just have to write down this equation, set k squared to 0. You get a really simple ODE for H, and you show that there is no solution that's both regular and normalizable. Okay? So this means that here the spectrum of masses is discrete and gapped. Okay? So there is a mass gap here, and then a discrete spectrum. This is exactly what you expect in a confining theory, like Young-Mills, which in addition is expected to have a mass gap. Okay? Instead, here, if you do the same exercise, what happens? Well, what happens is that out here, you still have to demand regularity. But now you have a horizon, so you don't have the analog of this regularity condition at the origin. The mode just falls through the horizon. So here you only have one condition, and that's why the spectrum here is continuous and ungapped. Is this clear? As you expect in a non-confining phase. And finally, and I'll just leave you with that, another way to show that this is the correct way to look for the physical states in the gauge theory is that you can prove, I'm not going to do it, but you can prove that every normalizable mode, regular and normalizable mode of this form for the dilaton with k squared equals minus m squared equals minus k squared gives you automatically a pole in the two-point function of this operator. So if you compute trace of f squared of k minus k, okay, this two-point function has poles exactly at the values of k squared for which the solution for the dilaton over here has a regular and normalizable solution. It's regular and normalizable. Is this clear? The poles of this two-point function correspond to the physical states, the masses of the physical states in the theory with the quantum numbers of trace of F squared. Yes? No? Is this clear to everybody that in quantum field theory, if you want to find the spectrum of states with a given quantum number, you look at the two-point function of an operator with that, with those same quantum numbers, and the poles, okay, when you get something like 1 over p squared minus m squared, okay, a pole of this type signals the presence of a physical state with mass m squared, right? So what I'm saying is that precisely the values of k squared for which the dilaton has regular normalizable solutions, those are, you can prove, are exactly the same values of k squared for which this two-point function, which is the operator dual to a dilaton, has poles. That proves that these values of k squared are really the masses of physical states in the theory. Okay? So what I want you to take away is that in order to find the spectrum, you have to look at regular normalizable solutions of this form. Because this may appear later, tomorrow, meaning. Okay, and I think that's, yeah, just a sec. That's all I wanted to say, so.
Can we compare this spectrum with the spectrum measure of the experience? Because this should be the spectrum of the measures.
Ah, good. This is not, sorry, say that again.
I mean, because this is a pair of the quark and anti-quark. So it's correspondent to the spectrum of the mesons.
No, these are not mesons because this theory has no quarks. Mesons are Q Q bar bound states, right? But this theory has no meaning, this qi, qi. This is what a meson operator is, right? But this theory has no quarks. It has adjoint fermions and all of that, but let me not get into that. For the purpose of this discussion, it's enough to think of this theory as having only gluons. Okay, so what's the analog of this for gluons? Well, it's something like Fij, Fjk, where F is dA. Okay, this is the gluon field. This is a gauge invariant operator constructed out of the gluons. And so this acting on the vacuum can create a state only made out of gluons. Okay? So you know a quark is a quark, and sorry, a meson is a quark antiquark bound state. A baryon is a quark 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 bound state. And a gluon is a gluon 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 n gluons bound state. Yes, I'll tell you about that tomorrow. Yes, I've worked a lot on that. Yes, yes. It depends on the model. But yes, you can definitely calculate those masses and make predictions for, I mean, those masses in QCD, you can measure them. But those masses in the quark gluon plasma, you cannot measure them. And those are not known. So that's one area in which you can really make predictions as opposed to post-dictions. And that's an area of very, very intense research. So the physics of mesons in, so adding quarks to these theories is something that is a field that is really developing very quickly. Any more questions? And it's a field that I have mainly worked on. I mean, everything I've told you so far is rather old, meaning between 5 and 10 years. Okay? What I'll tell you about tomorrow, I'm still not sure what I'll tell you about tomorrow, but whatever it is, it will be more recent. Any other questions? Okay, so then we'll finish.